When you hold me in your arms so tight, you let me know everything's alright.
Ah, hooked on a feeling. Good morning.
Good morning.
My picture looks like a mockingbird, huh? From the Secret Six.
Your picture.
All in shadow.
Yes. For a second there, for some reason when you said mockingbird, my mind immediately went to the other main comic book universe.
Oh, the female.
Yes.
Yeah. See, so I'm wearing my boobs and I have a blonde wig on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was trying to figure out how you and Shadow equaled blonde woman, but... So it's a little confusing, but that's okay, because...
Are you recording, by the way?
Yes, I am.
Cool deal.
Yeah, I've gotten in the habit of pulling out my pretty May.
Yeah, right. Pull it out.
Showing it to the world.
That's right.
So we had happy birthday to Buck Rogers recently.
Yeah, happy birthday, Buck.
And now we have happy birthday to Michael Myers.
Yes, that's right. Happy birthday. Happy birthday to me. And happy I'm all depressed because I'm remembering things of the past. How I used to be able to look out my window and see stuff.
Mm-hmm. And now you're too blind.
I can't see. I can't move. I'm sore. I don't know.
You can't get over to the window.
Can't get over to the window.
Yeah, you're feeling the approach of the big 5-0, I guess.
Yeah. I'm getting there. Round up, and I'm there.
Yeah, your post to Facebook confused me a little bit. It made me wonder if you were older than I thought you were for a second.
Mm.
I don't think he's that close to 50. And thankfully, your wife clarified it for me in the comments.
Yeah.
But, you don't want to round up when you're talking about your own age. Don't want to rush time along.
Yeah, I'm going to go back in time, like Kronos.
But I guess the older we get, the more material we have for this podcast.
Yeah, that's true.
Sometimes
we get to add an extra year.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Yep. Sometimes I read something new and I think, 10 years from now, I'll talk about this on the Retrocast. And I just save my thoughts. I don't tell anyone what I think about new comics.
Yeah. I read some that didn't quite make the cut because of our 10-year rule, but
yeah,
I did read a lot of older stuff, and I read a lot of the all-new Atom, and God, I enjoyed the hell out of it.
Yeah.
I got stuck, and then...
That's what, 2006?
Yeah, it was 2006, 2007.
That was right around 1 year later, right?
Yeah.
Coming out of Infinite Crisis and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Where Ryan Coe is the Atom.
Is that how you say it? Or is it...
Either that or Cho.
Cho, something like that.
I don't know.
Yeah, it's funny, because I had never read that series, and I picked up...
It's spelled C-H-A-O-I? C-H-O-I.
Yeah.
Cho. I don't know if you pronounce the I. I don't know.
Yeah.
What do I know? But I think he's my favorite Adam. Like, I really like what they're doing with Ray Palmer now and the with Frankenstein. Like, I really enjoy that. But
He's a bit more of a mad scientist
yeah,
kind of guy now.
he's a crazy mad scientist, like Einstein kind of thing going on with the hair and the beard and but as far as like the science and the humor and making Ivy Town like really weird, I really like what Gail Simone and Rick Remender did. It was good stuff. I especially like Rick Remender's closing story arc. It was cool.
Well, I can definitely speak from experience that Ivy Town is a very strange place to be.
That's it is.
I live it every day, and it is bizarre.
Yes.
It is a strange place. But what can I say? You know,
Yeah,
what's
especially when that place doesn't have caffeine in their system.
when ha
Then
what
they think
happens
they need
in
to get call the doctor. Something's wrong. I don't feel like I just want to sleep all the time.
What happens in Ivy Town stays in Ivy Town,
That's right.
unless it ends up on the 5 o'clock news. Well, speaking of birthdays, my sister gave birth on Friday,
Nice.
so there was a new birthday.
You're an uncle.
So I'm an uncle
Boy or
and
girl?
girl,
Ah.
and I met her yesterday, not even 24 hours old. That's the youngest baby I've ever held. I gotta imagine,
Yeah.
'cause
It's pretty surreal, isn't it? I mean,
I was sitting there, my sister's still in the hospital. She ended up having a C-section, so she'll be there till tomorrow. But I'm just sitting there thinking, this baby hasn't grown since my. Since it was born. So it was this big, before my sister gave birth, and it's just crazy. Even though technically she's really small, it's still pretty big for being inside of another person.
Yeah.
But it's pretty amazing. So while I was holding her, and Kara, my sister, were talking. I started whispering her some details about superheroes. I started her education. Figure, she's not even a day old yet, but it's not too late to learn. So I started telling her, so Wonder Woman is an Amazon, and she's from the Isle of Themyscira, and then there's this guy named Batman. His real name is Bruce Wayne. And my sister stopped to say, "Are you talking about superhero stuff over there?"
Do you know that Wonder Woman broke the neck of Maxwell Lord?
Yeah, I think I'll wait a little while till.
Just tell her that.
We'll start with the PG rated version.
Speaking of 1 year later, that's what came out of it, right? She snapped his neck. Maxwell Lord shot Blue Beetle in the head, dead cord.
Yeah, that was all in the lead up to Infinite Crisis.
The sad part too is as I was reading this All New Adam and saying, God, I really like this guy. I remembered I read Titans and Deathstroke and them killed him. And I was like, damn. I mean, that doesn't mean he won't show up in the New 52, but
Right.
something's going to happen, I think, this September, or maybe a little bit after it in the new DCU. That's going to, they're putting little seeds in there. They're planting things, and I don't know if they're doing it on purpose or what, but like even Superboy, he like punched a wall again. Now there's like 52 Superboys in the comic. I'm like, what the fuck is going on?
Yeah, Yeah, I think they're even planning ahead as far as next September with what they're doing right now. I think they
Yeah.
got a, which is good because I think when the new 52 started, they hadn't planned ahead that far. In other words, I think the original New 52, I think they, I don't think that they, I think at some point they had, I think they had different plans to continue the old universe, and I think at some point when they decided they were going to do the New 52, they kind of hit the ground running and then have been kind of filling in the backstory as they go. And I think that they've, I think it's been around long enough that they've gotten where they are ahead of themselves with what they're planning. Whereas I think at first they were just kind of throwing stuff out there with Pandora and all that kind of business that was kind of like we'll figure it out later kind of stuff. But right now I feel like things are pretty laid out. I think they have a pretty good roadmap of where they're heading for the next year. Things seem a little bit more controlled, I don't know. But one thing looking at the past shows you is it goes in cycles.
Yeah, just like the Atom. It wasn't Ray Palmer.
Nope. And yeah, it will be interesting because really the only Atom they've had so far in the New 52 is the one that turned out to be a traitor, right?
Well, they have Ray Palmer, and he is wearing the Atom costume underneath, right?
Yeah, I guess that's true. I guess he hasn't done a lot of superheroing,
But he is
so.
still, I still think he is shrunk down. I mean, they were in that ant, what do they call it? The ant farm or whatever, that's like only a couple of centimeters wide, and it's like a whole planet of
Yeah.
that organization, so.
Yeah, the technology definitely is there, and there was that Batman su or Superman Batman issue that Jeff Lemire wrote that had to do with the Atom.
Yeah.
But
But you saw the other Adam, the one from the Crime Syndicate.
Yeah.
She's an evil bitch, man.
Yeah. So, yeah, so that was my big, we went up to the hospital yesterday. That was
Well, congrats. That's awesome.
thanks. Yeah. I'm pretty excited. It's just it'll be interesting to
It's a big year for you.
I know. Yeah, there's a lot going on. A lot of good stuff with my family this year, which is nice, but
And if things get bad with your family, you just fart and you lighten up the mood.
Right. It's
Don't
like
think
being,
I would ever do that, but
well, you know, it's only, it's a, you know, you can't overuse it. It's not a weapon you can overuse. You gotta hold it back and keep it for the really serious situations.
Right.
But it's nice to always have that. You know, it's not something I can forget to take with me, like a cell phone or something. My intestines are always with me, so I'm always armed.
And all that grass you eat,
It's like
all that
concealed carry.
butt.
It's like a concealed carry almost, you know. But I don't have to get a permit. I just.
You should have to. If you're gonna fire it in public.
Well, I'll say this, if Keith registers his, I'll consider going on the books as well.
Register your mutant ability.
Yeah. The Registration Act. Flatulence Restoration Act, or rest, yeah, restoration.
Did you watch the new Buck Rogers, or did you kind of skim through it?
I watched the whole thing. But I did kind of zone out
Yeah.
at
It
points.
was just kind of like who's the villain who's messing with us, and I have to revisit the past in order to figure out who that villain is. I can't believe they even went to the robot one. Like, why would they think that that robot from that prison planet would come back?
Yeah.
Like, some of them were a waste of time. And then the other thing I thought was interesting is, you know, when that one episode with the old people where they bombed that asteroid, mm-hmm. where those people were, I thought those guys were dead. And
yeah.
They basically said they weren't.
Yeah, one thing it was funny to me is, so it was a clip show, and it did make me think about the fact that when I was a kid in the 80s, the clip shows were a lot more often. I mean, it was disappointing when you sat down and tuned into a show, but I think, and it turned out to be a clip show, but sometimes it wasn't so bad just because being able to rewatch stuff wasn't as easy back in the day.
Yeah.
And maybe that's why they've stopped doing them, because people can rewatch the episodes so easily. But obviously, it was a way in getting the episodes out in the production schedule. They could just bring the cast in and record.
You know what I loved about it though is they put all the goofy dance scenes in there.
Yeah.
Like I mean, here it is, Buck Rogers, and the things you're recapping as the roller skating in front of Princess Ardala.
Yes, I got to see
that,
my roller
skating. That funky skin. Dancing.
I paid attention to that. I looked up from my computer and made sure I rewatched my beautiful roller skating dance. Because I was actually into seeing that again. And, you know, there was a few things that were with the framing story that the new material that was entertaining. I mean, I thought it was funny that when Buck first sits down in the chair, so, you know, there's a screen, a television nearby that projects the person's thoughts, and that's the explanation of how they're reviewing this material that from the old episodes and stuff. And when they first put him in the chair, they just tell him to relax and just think whatever happens to come to mind. And so then on the screen you see just a succession of every single hot woman that's been in the show so far.
Yeah.
That's what he immediately starts thinking of.
And it goes back to what you said the last episode, how they've kind of like framed it so like Erin Gray or Wilma is not even interested in him as a partner, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was something
more
else I was
a,
thinking about.
She cares about him as a coworker, but yeah. And she loves him, I think, as a friend, but mm-hmm. it's not going any further than that. Because
yeah,
she didn't get jealous when she saw those mm-hmm. women. She kind of just started laughing.
Yeah, she's got a smirk on her face, just kind of bemused. And that actually is something I was thinking about, because it is surprising to me, as someone who's never seen the show, I really was going into it expecting that they were going to play up that kind of Scully and Mulder. Scully and Mulder. kind of romantic tension sort of thing. When you have a male and a female lead around the same age, that's usually the approach. So I was totally expecting that. And it has been interesting that they haven't gone that route. Just kind of playing up Buck as this kind of romantic lead and just with all of his co-stars instead of her.
Yeah.
I wonder if there's a reason that they did that. You know, it would be kind of a question.
I don't know.
If I had a chance, I
have no idea what happens in the second season. Like, I don't, mm-hmm. I don't remember it at all. All I mm-hmm. remember is they have that Falcon guy. Like, they introduced that strange character that's got like a bird head. You know, not even a bird head, but he looks like he's got like a bald eagle on top of his skull.
Whoa, that sounds weird.
But that's all I remember from the second season. I don't remember anything, so I don't know if we're watching the second season, but I'm going to watch it. I'm going to continue it just because I don't remember it. Like, all these episodes I sort of remember. Even this one, because I remembered it was the Gary Coleman president guy that was playing games with them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I kind of got a little bit of a spoiler of that, just because I usually look up the episode list on Wikipedia,
Yeah.
and the only guest star it had listed was Gary Coleman, but I sort of didn't spoil it though, because I was, when I saw that, I just kind of assumed that it was because he was reappearing in it as a clip. And you know, and Wikipedia is edited by just people that feel like editing it, so I just thought maybe the person threw, somebody threw that on there and didn't list all the people that reappeared in the clips. But yeah, so it turns out that Gary Coleman's character is responsible for this device that ends up suddenly appearing in the room.
Yeah, and I guess he's got flaws. Like, he's, yeah, I know there's mistakes setting off your security alarms. It's like, oops.
Yeah, he's got this technology. He can just teleport objects into their headquarters. And but yeah, he hasn't worked out the details in such a way that he's like, sorry, I think I may have set off some alarms. And their response is kind of sarcastic, and that oh, you know, that's no problem, it's only, we've only got the whole base mobilized and on alert.
Yeah, it was like the whole place, no matter what room they would be in, would go woo woo woo.
Mm-hmm.
And so the red lights would come on, and it was,
yeah,
the whole security, the whole place in Chicago was on red alert.
Also,
they
he
essentially
could send down
th-
champagne and stuff.
Yeah, they essentially thought he was gonna, whatever was gonna happen was gonna destroy that area if Buck didn't solve the limerick, the riddle before the timer went off. He even ported a hourglass in there so they could tell like when the game was gonna be up.
Right, yes. That happens at the beginning. There's a, all of a sudden, it reminded me of a Jeopardy screen. It looked like a Jeopardy answer coming up on the screens on that TV show, where it was the blue background with the white text. And it's a riddle for Buck to solve, and that's sort of why they go through all these, why they take turns, him and Wilma, and even Twiggy. Get hooked up to this machine that shows their thoughts. And the Twiggy episode, I realized that the whole point was to save budget and stuff, but it would have been super awesome if they had shown, if they had filmed new material and had actually shown that episode from Twiggy's perspective.
Mm-hmm.
That could have been really funny. But it was the Miss Cosmos episode, which was, I mean, it was a good choice in the sense that he was particularly involved in that episode, and it was definitely a Twiggy, that was probably one of the best Twiggy episodes. But yeah, overall, it was pretty much a clip show. But funnily, you know, we were watching these even slower than if it was a weekly aired TV show, watching them twice a month. So it did actually jog my memory of some stuff that, yeah, I wouldn't say I necessarily forgot, but if you would have mentioned it, I would have remembered it. But I did find myself throughout the episode going, oh yeah, mentally, just remembering some of the, especially some of the earlier episodes, and, you know, seeing Jack Palance overact again, and sort of refreshed my memory, I guess.
Well,
going
it's a good,
forward.
Like jumping on point to give you a spotlight of what's happened.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if they chose the best clip. Like, if you're, why isn't people roller skating here and dancing?
Yeah.
And then why are they dancing with strings?
Yeah, the string rope dancing.
There's a lot of 70s dancing in there.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, you're right. If you couldn't just hop on Hulu or Netflix or something like that to catch up with the show if you started watching it back in the day. So if you hadn't seen some of these earlier episodes, you'd probably be a little bit more attentive to your television when they popped up.
Such
yeah.
A weird time, because that was, most people didn't have VCRs or anything, you know?
Yeah.
So it was like, you watch it at the time it comes out, or you miss it.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of technology, or not really technology, but there's a lot of entertainment that's gone by the wayside that used to be around, and especially in the 70s and early 80s, and it was a lot bigger deal when a TV sh when a movie came onto television as a chance to re-see it, and you had movies that came back into theaters a lot more often because people didn't have any other way of seeing it and would pay to see it again, and you had a lot of print material based off of movies and stuff for that reason. I was actually listening to, so Marvel has a podcast, an official podcast, and they tend to just be celebrity guests and stuff, and I don't really usually listen to it, but I've been keeping an eye out now for future episodes with Peter Sanderson, the comics historian. They've done three now, one on the 60s, one on the 70s, and recently the one on the 80s came out, so I have listened to those, and man, I mean, he can just talk, and he just goes, and they just ask him a question, and he'll just run it down. Like in the 70s episode, and he just was going through all the just the different creators that came to Marvel, but maybe it was in the 70s episode. I can't remember if it was the tail end of the
Is it a vi
70s.
is it a video thing or a podcast?
Podcast, just
Okay.
the audio thing, but I think it was there that recently I heard someone talking about the Star Wars series at Marvel. Maybe, I mean, I listen to so much stuff I get mixed up in my head, but anyway, the point is that just Marvel was a lot more into licensing properties around that time, and they would put their top some of their top creators on these licensed properties, and it was just at a different time when Marvel and DC both weren't so they didn't have their eggs in as many baskets, so they weren't pushing their own properties as heavily, to the exception of other things, and so they had a lot more licensed properties, and things like ROM and Shogun Warriors and Micronauts and Star Wars and things like that would get a lot of attention from the creators. And sometimes, in the case of things like Star Wars, you might collect those not just because you're a fan of the property, but because you had no other way of revisiting the movies, or you might buy these photograph books and things like that that would come out because it was your only way of you had that magic of seeing the film, and you had no way of sitting down and watching the film, so you would buy these books just so you could look at the pictures because that was your only access to that universe, so something sort of retro related, just interesting to think about how the demand for certain types of products is not really there in the same way. Except for like collectors going back and getting that stuff, but we don't really get the same kind of new material. Because people could just, after about, 6 months, 7 months, you could just buy the Blu-ray and rewatch the movie to your heart's content. Definitely not a bad change, but it's interesting to think about how certain products go out of demand because of technology changes. But I guess I didn't pay 100% attention to the episode, but I didn't hate watching it either. And it did kind of remind me of those clip shows that I'd see, shows like Cosby Show and things growing up, how they would have those.
Yeah, it seems like all the sitcoms would have that at some point.
Yeah, and you didn't really mind as much because it bring back old episodes you loved, or it was a chance to see some jokes that you forgot about and things. So, it's kind of funny we went. This was called the Blast for Buck. It's kind of funny we went from Happy Birthday Buck to a Blast for Buck. I guess the festivities are continuing.
The whole thing was that it was New Year's Eve, And he's like, "What day is this?" And then like that's when Gary Coleman transports champagne to the place and burgers, cheeseburgers and fries made from lizards.
Yeah, I was gonna say, I don't, yeah, the meat was something weird, wasn't it? Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and maybe they were saving some money because next episode to get right back into the groove of things, we get our Dollar Returns. We have Pamela Hensley and Tiger Man and Kane all coming back next time around, so we'll be getting back into groove for sure there. So this is, and that will be episode 17 of the season one. So that means we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 left. The last two episodes being a two-parter. So we haven't had one of those in a while.
Yeah.
Been quite a while since we had a two-parter.
Season 2 is really short, too.
Yeah, it looks like 13 episodes. So.
And the first one is a part 1 and 2. I mean, two of them are the same episode.
The first four. So the season two begins with two-parters. When they originally aired, they were 2-hour episodes, and then they syndicated them as two-parters. Same thing with the final episode of season one. 2-hour episode later syndicated as a two-part episode. It'll still take us a while to get through these, but yeah, I mean, at least at this point, I'm pretty damn curious about season two because how many people have said that it's a poor thing, so that it's pretty bad. So unless we dive into it and it just becomes intolerable to talk about, but sometimes bad movies and bad TV
Just as
are
fun.
good podcasting material, so
Yeah.
I think people who are following along are pretty interested to hear what we think about this, about season two. So I'm curious, and I don't know how bad something can be that has our Wilma Deering a
I
part of
know how
it.
bad can it
It
be?
can only be so bad.
Yeah.
You posted your autographed photograph of her that you had from.
I did.
I feel.
I have two of them. I have that one that I got from Denver Comic Con, which was fairly recent, and then I have one from 2006 or 7 from San Diego Comic Con.
Yeah, I have to. I think I might have to keep an eye on Erin Gray's schedule. Maybe one of these days, as a sort of,
She's really nice.
yeah, that's what I've heard. And one of these days is kind of to cap off my coverage of her television show as a sort of reward. I'll have to try to meet her.
Yeah.
I usually don't make much of an effort to meet celebrities, but.
I had a chance to meet Gil Gerard, but I didn't. So.
Well, I can see where your priorities lie. And I can't blame you.
They weren't at the same place. It was
Yeah.
if I had a choice, there wouldn't be a ch I mean, there wouldn't be any question.
No, I know which line I would get in. It's funny how, when you start to type a name in, or not, well, I type anything into Google,
Yeah.
it shows you, it
Fills
starts
it
to
in.
autofill, yeah. One of the things when you type Erin Gray, and one of the things that comes up is Erin Gray spandex. Know what that's about. So that was our clip episode of Buck Rogers in the 25th century. And then get back in the groove of things next time around.
Yep.
So
So, what do you got for us in comics. I didn't post any questions, so we don't.
Yeah, I didn't ask for any either. So we can mix them up. Let's see.
Well, we did have a question. Damn it. This one came early, like really early. It was from Brian Regate, and it was the guy who contacted me a long time ago. He sent an email, and he was just thanking us for the episodes, and he was listening to the retro cast, and I guess we called him out in that episode, and he said he has a question, and he said, which comics characters do you feel have matured the most? Which is interesting. And then he gives an example of like Guy Gardner and Booster Gold, like they've matured from where they started off to where they are now or where they were pre-52.
So in the actual characterization of the character,
the
maturity level.
Matured or got older.
Yeah, those are great examples. I would say I definitely agree with his examples.
Yeah, Guy Gardner in the New 52 is no joke. Like, he's definitely a more serious character.
Mm-hmm.
And then there was Guy Gardner Warrior, where he was... where he didn't even have the ring.
Mm-hmm.
But he was part of that alien race that he could turn his whole body into a weapon.
Yeah. He's been through a lot of iterations. I feel like a lot of he's an interesting character because his Bwahaha Justice League characterization, the one that people look at as the most prominent, I would say that he's known for, of being this kind of quasi conservative, boastful, like egotistic guy that had a lot of clashes with Batman and stuff.
Wasn't afraid to say what was on his mind and wasn't politically correct about anything.
Right. What I've always found interesting is kind of how that wasn't the first iteration of the character was kind of a
more serious.
Yeah, and what didn't really like. I think that they looked at it and thought we gotta change this guy up because he didn't really have all that much to distinguish him from Hal Jordan.
Yeah.
I mean, it didn't really have a whole lot to strike out and make them different. It's almost like,
it was either that or they were like, who can we have? That's a Green Lantern.
Yeah.
Well, you can have this guy. We're not using him.
Yeah. 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 Maybe it wasn't so much a priority as well. This guy, it's nothing going for him. So if you want to make him into a politically incorrect character that, which that definitely happens. But I think I accidentally reminded myself of another one that I guess might kind of qualify would be Jason Todd.
Yeah.
Because he was as Robin, again, a character that initially didn't have a whole lot to distinguish him from Dick Grayson. Then when they did distinguish him, it was by kind of making him more of a delinquent. And more hot-headed, and then when he came back as the Red Hood, I feel like in the New 52, he's still got that roguish aspect to him, but if he's an anti-hero, I think that they've, in the New 52, emphasized the hero part of that a little bit more, it made him more of a good character.
Yeah, you could say that about Damian, too. When Damian first hit, people were like, who is this spoiled brat? Who's this? And I think all the way up until the point he died, they built him up to you really cared about him.
Mm-hmm.
They made him into a character that you wanted to see in a book.
Yeah.
And he wasn't as annoying.
Right. I'm trying to think of I'm trying to think of some Marvel
His
examples.
His dog even... brought out a lot of caring in him. They got him that dog, things started to change a little bit.
Yeah, I love that. obviously, because I love dogs. But Titus, he's awesome, and he's been. I love that Tomasi has not forgotten about Titus. You know that he's actually
Yeah,
helping Batman.
he still shows up, yeah.
Yeah, he's part of the team. Like he was helping recently in Batman and Robin. You know, it's recent. I won't say too much about it, but I thought it was awesome that Titus was at Batman's side helping fight.
Yeah.
That was pretty sweet.
Kitty Pride.
That's a good Marvel example.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean she's been headmistress and she's really like a mentor to younger X-Men now than when she was once upon a time the young X-Men.
Yeah. Pre-52 Impulse, but that's not Marvel. After that scene where Deathstroke took his legs or whatever and he started to read and stuff, and he became much more mature
Right. Yeah,
in
when
that
he
Geoff Johns run, yeah.
became Kid Flash. And then it wasn't successful, but he was briefly the Flash.
Yeah. So, you could say Wally West too when he had to become the Flash. He had to grow up and take the mantle.
Yeah, he was an interesting character for the new Teen Titans because I was actually doing some reading of some older interviews with Wolfman and Perez about, you know, when it was when it's still in the 80s and the new Teen Titans was still going on, and just how they weren't really. Kid Flash was a part of the team, and then Kid Flash, as time goes on, sort of fades to the background. And he's an interesting character because he was, when that series started, he really was not interested in continuing to be a superhero, and he was having problems with his powers. His powers were literally killing him if he used them too much. And as his biology changed, and as he went through puberty and stuff, because he got these powers when he was a kid. And I guess behind the scenes, part of that was intentional because Wolfman and Perez were talking about how, as a character, he was hard to write and hard to include because the more you develop the Flash's powers, and if you really stop and sit down and think about what he's capable of, it's hard to put a limit on. It's like Superman almost. It's even though his power set is more concentrated, it just they felt like it was really easy to cause that character to just to dominate if they didn't put some kind of barrier or limit on his powers. You know, and he just kind of ends up as the run goes on for a while there, he's just kind of once the issues with him being coerced into coming back to being a hero from by Raven and stuff, he ends up fading back into the background and getting concentrating on school again and being in a relationship and everything, you know, until around the crisis time when he ends up stepping up and taking the mantle of the Flash. But yeah, he was in that series. He was. His characterization was kind of reflected his upbringing in the Midwest, coming from like a little bit more of a conservative background, a little bit more of little more sheltered. And I think once he was the Flash and he got exposed to being in the Justice League and got to see more of the world, you sort of saw that he still had his like. He still had his roots coming up in the Midwest, but he his mind got a little more expanded and to other seeing the rest of the world and stuff. They had that issue where the original Starfire, like the Russian character,
Red Star.
Yeah, when they well, like Starfire, like he was a like a character that had that name Starfire before Coriander.
I thought his name was Red Star.
Maybe.
Because the other Starfire was another female, and she was more like in the sci-fi fantasy.
Yeah,
Here,
maybe
let
I'm
me
getting
look
mixed
up
up.
real quick.
I know. Well, either way, I know there was like
I know which one you're
a
talking
Russian
about. He had red
character.
hair, kind of like a greenish gray outfit, and a red circle in the middle. Yeah, his name's Red Star. It's from
Yeah,
Titans.
I think okay. We're actually both correct, because I think once Starfire was known as connected with Coriander, they gave him the name Red Star because it says he first appeared in the under the name Starfire in Teen Titans 18, the
Ah.
volume 1, December 1968, not to be confused with the female DC character. So that was his first appearance, but he doesn't reappear till that's kind of funny. It was also issue 18 of the new Teen Titans in 1982. And because there's a new Starfire, he subsequently changed his code name to Red Star.
So you were talking about 1968 then, where he
Well, no,
first
I mean,
appeared.
I was talking about how I was talking about the New Teen Titans 1982 issue, but I
Okay.
was just talking about how he was originally called Starfire, and I was
Yeah.
just remembering that he was originally called Starfire and then changed his name. But the reason I brought it up was just because in that issue, Kid Flash's interactions with him kind of, he's the one that sort of reflects like the Cold War attitude, like of suspicion and negativity towards Soviet Union at the time. So, which is it's interesting. So that's interesting to me because you might be able to tell by how much I'm blabbing on about Wally West is my favorite. So, and I'm not conservative, and I'm from the Northeast. I didn't grow up in the Midwest. But one of the things I like about the character is that he's like a he has sort of like working class route roots.
Yeah, he did.
So it's interesting how I can
He
connect
was
with him on that level.
easy to relate to than Barry. It's weird how they got the legacies because the originals were kind of like straightforward and not a lot of personality. And I don't mean like they didn't have one. I just there wasn't a lot of depth behind their personality. And then you got like Wally and Kyle, you know what I mean? And what they did, what I think they did good with those characters is they try to use like the Marvel approach, and they're trying to say like if any other person, like the person you can relate to, was a hero, then these would be those guys, and Wally, it's weird for me because me and you were, you know, quite a difference in age, and I grew up with the Flash being my favorite character, and you know, as Barry at the time, and when Wally took over, I latched on to him even stronger. You know what I mean? I just, it's weird because it's usually the inverse for a lot of people. That's not my Flash, you know. That's not my. And I think that new generation of heroes I really like. And we were just talking about Ryan Coe or Cho or Coy. I don't know how you want to pronounce it, but he's my Adam now, even though he's dead. That he I don't know. I think the stories for me just had me grow closer to that person as a character. I was like, wow, you know. And then the supporting cast that he had was pretty damn awesome. So, yeah, I think you could say in the DC it's easier to make pointed references because you have all those legacy characters. One thing that made DC really great before the new relaunch is you had all those legacies and you got to see them start off like Stargirl, for example. You got to see her grow and become one of the mentors for other heroes. You know what I mean? So, you get to see all these legacy heroes become mentors enough for the next legacy. So, yeah.
Yeah, I think that's part of the reason that DC started to really appeal to me as an adult, because I can look at that journey, I can identify with that journey. It's why Wally has become my favorite DC character, because I like to look at that journey. And as an adult, you know, you start to get to an age where I look at my dad and or whoever you have like as a parent figure to you, as a guy, I look at my dad and I see, okay, here's things that he accomplished and things that I admire about him, and hopefully I'll embody that value too, you know, and hopefully he'll look at me and he'll see that, like, he'll be proud of me and stuff. And so that's one of the reasons I gravitate, because I look at Wally, and I wasn't always that willing about the idea of following in someone else's footsteps or being like someone as like a teenager. You know, you want to rebel, you want to be different, and I didn't always embrace that. And so I look at Wally and I see a character who didn't always embrace, you know, when he was young, he was super excited about being Kid Flash, and then he's a teenager, he was uncomfortable with the idea and didn't know if he wanted to be a superhero anymore. And then when his mentor makes the sacrifice and dies, you know, that's when he starts to really take the idea of being the Flash seriously, and he matures and takes on that legacy and realizes this is something that I need to honor, and I need to really treat that with respect. And if Barry saw me today, I want him to be proud of what I'm doing with the legacy that he established, you know, and mm-hmm. And then you have Jay, in addition to that, Jay Garrick, and as like a sort of a grandfather figure, and like I can equate that to my own grandparents. And then you have the next generation coming up and looking at, like, once now, like, I'm an uncle and things like that, you want to sort of be able to be someone as well that others can look up to. And so eventually you got to that point where Wally had been around long enough that you have like Bart, and you have even his own two children and other heroes that are looking up to him now, mm-hmm. as an example. So that's probably the best explanation I can give as to, like, there's other characters that have that, especially in the DC universe, like Dick Grayson. I get some of that from those characters too. And I think just the reason that Flash stands out for me is in like a metafiction kind of way, from looking at it outside the comic book world, Dick is never like, he'll have these storylines where he's Batman, you know, but ultimately Dick is his own person. Like, the Dick stands alone. And
distinctively like the one that's did his own thing and did, you know, formed the Teen Titans for that matter. Yeah. He's like, and not only that, but Dick also, to me, served more as a father to Damian than Bruce. Mm-hmm. If you look at when Dick had the cowl, you know, and he was Batman, he treated Damian like a brother, but at the same time, he served as like a father figure to Damian.
Mm-hmm.
And he even grounded Damian even more, like with his values and stuff like that. Whereas before Dick was mentoring him, he was kind of a loose cannon, man.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's you see. I'm trying to think of Marvel, but man, I just I know Cyclops has become like a huge leader now, like where his decisions aren't as you know, green or red, like what do they call it? Straightforward decisions. There are a lot of gray areas, and his mm-hmm. decisions are very well thought out and strategic. I think he's grown as a leader.
Yeah, that's an interesting choice, because he's very
he's always been the leader of them, but until recently, I haven't respected his choices and stuff, but now I could follow his path and say, oh wow, he's really thought this through, and he's like in a damned if you do, damned if you don't situation most of the time, and he has to make these tough decisions, and he's grown definitely, in my opinion.
No, I think one of the changes there is that his characterization always included a lot of self-doubt, and I think wisely, because it had been pretty much covered to death, they've moved the character out of that aspect and made him, he's like a lot more confident now, and he makes his decisions, and we're not constantly reading about him second guessing himself and making mistakes and just not believing in himself. He's just like, he makes his choices and he moves forward, yeah, it's something you can really talk a lot about, and there's a lot of different examples and
It's easy for me to think of the DC characters, I guess just because I remember them more, but Peter Parker's definitely matured, but it's the same time he's trying to stay young through his sarcasm and wit.
Yeah.
Man, I could talk about DC all day. And Marvel, I know there's plenty of examples, but Wolverine is, I guess, he's always been a mentor to the young, like Jubilee and Kitty. He was a mentor to her, But he's kind of stepped up his game now as he's had to lead a school. So I guess you could say he's such a weird example, though, because on the side he'll do the black ops, if you will, and do what's needed to be done, but then he's still teaching, and that part has always bothered me. That's the part I don't like about Wolverine and the X-Men is because he's teaching, but he doesn't practice what he preaches, I guess.
Yeah, it's been kind of mixed, because then other times I think they've tried to get away from that a little bit. I know that there were some scenes, and I don't know if it was just like self-titled X-Men, or if it was the previous Uncanny X-Force or whatever it was, but I know there were some scenes with Psylocke where he was basically telling her, I need you to do this stuff because I can't be the one to do this stuff anymore. I need to be the headmaster, whatever. So maybe they were trying to get a little bit away from that hypocritum. They were trying to get away from making up new words and also hypocrisy. But
That's a word that you don't hear so often, hypocrisy. I always think of Tombstone when I hear that.
Carol Danvers, maybe you could
Oh,
say,
hell yeah. She's
going from Miss Marvel to Captain Marvel, and
and getting away from her alcoholism and stuff, and
yeah, they've dropped a lot of like, she's definitely grown to become a very like big role model, both in the inside of the comic Marvel universe and just in the real world to a lot of women. With the Carol Corps and all of that that's built up around that character. So she's not only grown, I would say, in the Marvel universe, but also sort of grown as an icon outside of comics. Or, within comics, but in the comic fandom instead of the Marvel universe. So
I can make a whole episode about that topic, especially if I'm prepared for it. These DC is easy for me because you do have that legacy and you can see the maturity of all the characters because a lot of them start off young and then they grow old. And then they're mentoring somebody else. But on the Marvel side, you kind of see that like with maybe Young Avengers and some of the other things that they're the other properties like Runaways and stuff. Well, some of those kids in the Runaways had to, they had to grow up, unfortunately. They're in a predicament where their parents were evil villains, so they had to grow up fast. They didn't have a choice.
Yeah. I think a lot of the new mutants now exist in more matured versions of themselves. The original New Mutants.
Cannonball.
Yeah, I maybe, but they haven't really received enough attention
lately.
Enough focus that it's really prominent. You know, that really sticks out. But they're definitely not treated as teenagers anymore.
Well,
they're
definitely
probably like early 20s, but
what's her name? God, Mirage. Is that what her name was? As a New Mutant, Native American.
Oh, we're talking about Danny,
yeah. She's definitely grown up, and half the time she's leading and she doesn't even have power sometimes. Because they always depower her.
She was in the Fearless
Defenders
a bunch of times. Yeah, she's a cool character. You know, I don't know if you want to talk about it as in like maturity as far as within the Marvel universe, within the story, but how they've written and changed the character is definitely matured a lot as Invisible Woman, going from, even in her name, Invisible Girl. I mean, she's gone from kind of in the early Fantastic Four stories to being probably like the least powerful to being the most powerful
and the one that, in my opinion, keeps the family together.
Mm-hmm. And keeping it in the family, at least, you know, at least if you look at the Hickman Fantastic Four, Johnny Storm is a huge, I mean, he really matured.
He really did, but then Matt Fraction destroyed that maturity.
Yeah, so that's why I specifically,
It's weird.
Has that been altered at all by how
Robinson?
Robinson has picked things up, or is he kind of just carrying
He's kind of carrying it with the torch. Mm-hmm. He hasn't really focused a lot on the torch. Robinson's doing a damn good job. I mean, I love the FF, and I love what he's doing with he's kind of like deconstructing the team right now. Like, mm-hmm. He's taking like what is the biggest fear for the Thing? What is Johnny loses his power? You know, he cares the most about that. What if Sue loses her family? Mm. What if Reed loses, you know, his ability to think straight? And he's kind of like focusing on that. And man, that comic, the way it's drawn and the way the storytelling is going on, I think it's one of my favorite Marvel books right now.
That's cool. Yeah, I'm looking. I stopped, like a lot of people did. I stopped reading. I kept reading FF, but I stopped reading Fractions, Fantastic Four pretty quickly. But
I fought through it.
Yeah, I saw that.
The FF is, I don't know, I kind of hold them close. It's like Flash for me. Like, I'll never stop. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. I can't.
Yeah, no matter what.
On the Marvel side, it's like Daredevil and the Fantastic Four. I have to read it, even if it's bad, because sometimes, like you said, the bad could be good. Like there's some things in the Fraction run that were good. I can't name a lot of them that I personally liked. I know there were people, some of my friends on Facebook liked what he was doing, but and that's good, because at any given time, somebody's going to appeal to other people. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So if a new reader discovers them and it gets them on board, then all for that. But I personally think you would like Robinson's take on the FF right now.
Yeah,
I
like him
got
as a writer,
so
so.
Engrossed into that story arc.
Yeah, I like him as a writer. I don't think it's popped up on. Yeah, I don't think it's popped up on Unlimited yet. I don't think it's caught up with.
It'll
I know.
probably,
I think an issue or two of
out,
Invaders
maybe.
is on there, but it's always 6 months behind. That's how I read most of my new Marvel. So it started some of the Marvel Now stuff that launched at the beginning of the year has been showing up. I'm kind of behind on my stuff in there,
yeah.
So I'm even more than 6 months behind.
I think Luke Cage has matured a lot since he had his child.
Yeah, that's a character that's definitely been moved along. He's embraced a lot of, instead of just being a hero for hire, he's embraced a lot of, he's been in the leadership role a lot ever since, you know, Bendis did a lot for him.
Yeah, he did a
You
lot
know,
for his character.
whatever you think of Bendis's writing, I know he has his fans and his detractors, but there are certain characters that he is really responsible for bringing out of obscurity and making, like, bringing them up to date to the modern day, like Luke Cage and Spider-Woman. Nobody was really doing a whole hell of a lot with Spider-Woman. There's a bunch of characters he liked, so he put a focus on them, you know. But you know, it looks like Choi is pronounced like that. Choi is
Choi.
pronounced Choi. I guess it's one of the most common Korean last names, and at least one spot that I'm looking says that it's pronounced like the word choice without the CE at the end. So Choi.
Ryan Choi.
Ryan Choi. So
I thought he was Chinese, though.
I think it's also a Chinese name.
Because he went back to China to visit, like, the love of his life.
Mm-hmm.
Who basically was Lady Kronos. Oh, shit. I could talk about that story arc. It's so good.
Yeah, it comes up on Wikipedia as a Korean surname, but it has the character for it in Chinese as well, and then it also but the place that I have showing the pronunciation is also says it's Chinese, so I think it's both.
I'll probably
Shui.
get it right half the time, just because you know how you get used to saying, like I say dark side. Some people say dark seed. You get in the habit of saying it, and you won't. It's hard to get out of the habit. Like Ra's al Ghul, I say Ra's al Ghul. But if you listen to the cartoon, you know, if you see him in a cartoon, they'll say Ra's.
Yeah.
So, who knows? But Neil Adams, I think, will say Ra's. So,
yeah, I came across something like that, not a character, but of a creator, you know, Klaus Janson.
Yeah.
I guess I saw something that it's actually Johnson.
I'll always say Janson.
I know, I saw that, I'm like, that's not going to stick
well,
in my head.
Well, for the longest time, I could not say Mark Miller because I would say Mark Millar. And it's pronounced Miller, like he said that.
Mm-hmm.
Just probably a year ago, I finally got over it and I could say it right. But I still think in my mind it's Millar.
Yeah, it probably still slips out sometimes.
Yeah.
If you don't stop and think about it first.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It's not disrespect. It's just I can't pronounce it.
Yeah. Right, like when I accidentally call you like me Rays. I'm not disrespecting,
That's
just
right.
being a weirdo.
All right. You want to jump into comics?
Yes.
Well, I'll go first. I'll talk real quick about Batman Gotham Knights 37. If you remember, three episodes ago, I probably talked about the last story arc where Bane was supposedly Bruce Wayne's brother. Well, this is like a standalone story, and it focuses on Cobra with a K, which is a villain. It's essentially a cult within the DC universe that worship this snake, kind of like Hydra, you know, DC's
Yeah.
version of Hydra. And
Justice Society fights them a lot.
they're gonna blow up like a lot of buildings and stuff like that, and Batman's capturing them. And this focuses on the spoiler. This is weird because it's kind of depressing actually, because Batman's kind of like putting aside spoiler, like she has no business being part of the Bat family because she failed. And it doesn't really mention what she did to make Batman feel this way, but something happened, and I don't remember what it was. And he gives her a second chance here. He's like, if you can solve and find this last guy, but of course Batman already knows how to find him, and he's got somebody working on it. Well, she fails to find that last Cobra agent, but he had Metamorpho. Actually, Rex actually stopped him from blowing up part of Gotham, and so she failed. And basically, Tim goes to console her. You know, he's like, she's like really upset, and he's like, Steph, you know, he is such a jerk. And Robin basically says, I know, I know. But it's a cool story, and at the end, it has her on the rooftops, like she's not gonna stop trying, you know. And but it's a good story. It was Let me see who the creative team. It was Scott Beatty again and Roger Robinson on art. It was a good story. I liked it. It had a Batman Black and White by Mike Carey and Steve Mannion. Mannion, you probably see doing his own book now. It's called like something Bomb. It's not Bomb Queen. I can't remember the name of it. I've read it, but he draws the art, and it's pretty much Scarecrow getting drugged with his own formula, and him and his minions, and they're so drugged on it that they think they're in medieval times, and Batman's a demon. But it was just kind of a done in one story. In the next issue, it says that Huntress is going to be the next character they focus on. Really nice Brian Bolan cover. The Brian Bolan covers on these are phenomenal. Worth the cost of admission just for the cover, in my opinion. They're brilliant.
I could see that. I know he does some sweet covers.
So this was from March 2003. Made the window.
Yeah. Just under the wire.
Just under the wire, yeah.
Was that just a one shot then, or?
It was a one shot before the next story arc.
Yeah.
So the last story arc was like four issues, that Bane story arc. And this was just a one shot between the two issues. But I think the next one's like a three issue arc.
Yeah, I like when they do that, take a breather in
Yeah.
between story arcs. Well, I continued from last week my focus on indie books. Maybe for next time I'll go back to one of the big two, but this time around, I got some more number ones. And the first one is by a writer that we've talked about on the show before, but I don't think we've talked about his own work as much as we've talked about him in relation to another creator, and that's Mark Evanier.
Wait, can I take a
And
guess what you read, just based on that?
yeah, you probably can get it.
Well, I've read a lot of his work, and if it's independent, I'm gonna take a guess that it's Crossfire or DNA Agents.
No, you got it on the second one.
Ah,
DNA
DNA agents.
agents.
Okay.
Yeah. Science made them, but no man owns the
Yeah,
DNA agents.
I read the entire run of that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Yeah,
But
this is from
I read it late. That's like from the 80s, right?
Yeah, early 80s.
I read it in the 2000s.
Oh, okay. Yeah, it's this volume one, number one, has a cover date of March 1983. And it's from Eclipse Comics. Yeah, it's interesting. There's as you might guess from the title, there is this group of five people, three guys, two girls. As I said, it's written by Mark Evan Year before I get too far ahead of myself here, the creators, illustrated by Will Meugniot, speaking of not being able to pronounce stuff.
Munio. No,
Yeah.
I don't know. So,
Meugniot.
it looks like a French type name, doesn't it?
Meugniot. Inked by Al Gordon, that's a little easier. Lettering by Carrie McCarthy and coloring by Janice Cohen. There's a guy who is the sort of the funder behind this whole business, Mr. Krell, and he makes a public announcement that his daughter was well. There's a public there's a he has a press conference because people believe that his daughter was kidnapped from an estate in Acapulco. He's a billionaire. His first name's Lucius. Lucius Krell is his name. He holds a press conference to say that it, the whole story is a hoax, and the reporters that are there are trying to get him to comment on reports that his company Matrix Inc. is involved in international industrial espionage, and he doesn't respond to that comment. But then, as soon as the press conference ends, he's talking to one of his advisors. We see that pretty much everything that they just denied is true, that his daughter's been kidnapped, he doesn't want to let the police handle it because he would have to let them know what the ransom is, and that would reveal that they indeed are involved in industrial espionage, that they stole solar converter plans from the Japanese, and that's what the kidnappers are actually a asking for, that they will give him the plans or that they'll kill his daughter. So he reveals that he created a security force for just this type of situation, a project, a biotype project that was developed to handle the company's dirty work. And he's getting some warnings that it's too early to initiate the project to put it into action, but he's not interested in hearing any of that. And that's the DNA agents. We first see them in these large tubes hooked up to all kinds of wires and everything like that, as we tend to do with this kind of like scientific project experimentation on humans. But these are not we're not human beings that they put in and experimented on, but that were developed from, as the name implies, the DNA. So they're adults or young adults, but they are new to the world. There's, like I said, five of them. There's one called Serge, the guy. There's a woman named Amber, who's seems a little bit younger. There's a big guy named Tank, that they call Tank that for pretty obvious reasons. And then there's Rainbow, who's kind of got like more of a seductive aspect to her. And then finally, a guy named Sham, who seems pretty shy and seems to have kind of like a inferiority complex. So they're released out into the public. They put on normal clothing and are sent to the airport because they're going to be used to rescue the Lucius Krell's daughter, even though they're kind of like freshly born and don't know a lot about the real world. So a bulk of this is kind of following them as they sort of, in their inexperience, they're, making some tactical mistakes in battle. And there's this guy that's on this kind of sort of little vehicle that Captain America would ride around a lot with the Avengers that could fly, this like little one man air mobile kind of thing. He sits on like a motorcycle. And we see that he's has opportunities to blast some of the DN agents that they're like leaving their rears unguarded and and obviously experienced heroes know to protect their rears. So
Gotta
they
protect your butt.
exactly keep all orifices guarded is one of the superhero maxims. So they're not quite experienced enough to know that. So but what for whatever reason, this guy that's observing this is not taking the shot. So he's just kind of like he's kind of observing it and making a note to himself, but not taking the shot. And he's supposed at this point in the story, he should be an enemy to them. So it's a little it's a little suspicious that he's not taking advantage of the situation. So as they monitor the situation back at Matrix. Their mission continues, and eventually they catch up to the president's daughter, who is being held by these terrorists, and they go to rescue her, but one of the guys pulls a pistol and holds it to his daughter's head. One of the Rainbow, she's able to create illusions, which frightens away the guy that's holding the she creates this big purple monster that frightens away the guy holding the pistol for a second, long enough for them to disarm him, and they get her away. But the funny thing about rescuing his daughter, she's not very grateful. She's not excited or anything like that. She's more concerned with the fact that she feels like they took a risk to her life when they rescued her. She's like, "You idiots! You almost got me killed, bursting in like that when you had a gun pointed at me." And so they're not too happy with her attitude towards them, so they stuff her in a garbage can. It's just like just her head and her arms and legs are sticking out, so they like bent her in half and surged at this stuffed her in a garbage can. And apparently someone else is going to pick her up. So they're successful at their first mission and they report back, and Krell is real happy for them and tells them their next assignment is actually to go to school, that he's enrolled them in a local university. But then we see Krell, he meets with this shadowy figure and hands him some money. And as he's walking away from this shadowy figure, he says, "You know how expensive everything's getting, just to have your own daughter kidnapped." So, interestingly, he was behind the whole thing, and it seems like he kind of created the situation so that he could rush the DN agents into activity for his own reasons. He wanted an excuse to get them on the field. And the final part of the issue is that as the DNA agent's kind of integrating somewhat unsuccessfully to college life, we see Rainbow and what's her face, the other girl, Amber. They go to the woman's dorm, and there's these two girls, Kim and Renee, the Women's League welcome wagon, and they're just so happy to have them there. And they're trying to get they're trying to find out what kind of hair dye Rainbow uses on her hair, because she's got like a, like streaks of rainbow, like different colors in her hair to go with their name. And they're like, you know, wait till you see all the great activities we have here. There's a, you got a tryout as a song girl, and there's a Mardi Gras committee and a glee club and the chess club. And Rainbow's pretty cynical and is not having it. And Amber's much more naive. So she's going into, so the last sequence, there's another action sequence where there's a, an attack on a building, and Tank is holding it up all by himself. And they don't stay undercover very long, because they, most of them, then they end up revealing their powers so that this building doesn't collapse. And then they find out that they're not just there to integrate and to learn. When the president's daughter shows up, and they realize, not the president, but the, but Lucius Krell's daughter shows up, and they realize that they have to protect her. So Serge is a little embarrassed that this girl that he stuffed in a trash can, and he's going to have to interact with. And then in the background, there's a guy, a sniper, that seems like it's a valid concern that they need to protect her, because it's, there's a sniper in the background that's watching, like looking to try to find an opportunity to take a shot on her. So that was issue number one. And as was, it seems like a lot more common at the time, we get like a 2-page text piece at the back in place of the letters that tells a bit about the genesis of the series, how it came together. And seems like it was kind of like not even really sort of something that was planned out at first, that they came up with the vague concept and just sort of ended up getting rolling. So it's pretty interesting, though. And on the back, we have an ad for Eclipse Monthly.
Huge. Just, he's a huge Kirby guy.
Yeah. Well, that's, so yeah, that's why we have talked about him on the time, because he was actually Kirby's assistant towards the end of Kirby's career, and he's written a lot about Kirby, and
he goes to all the Kirby panels at like San Diego Comic-Con, and good friends with Sergio Aragonés or
Aragonés. Yeah, I think he's well, we've quoted some of his some of the afterwards that he had in the Kirby Fourth World omnibuses that we covered. He's got some stuff in there.
Yeah.
So very connected. And I think there was even something in the Fourth World saga that was similar. Was it directly called DN Agents or something similar to that name, where it was DNA something that Kirby created, so it's kind of takeoff, at least in the name.
Yeah, Kirby, so concept. It was a single character.
Yeah.
I can't remember the character now, but...
So kind of more of an aspect of taking the name and creating something different out of it.
I think they were mindless things that went after... They were like drones or something. They called.
Yeah, sounds right.
I think they sent him after the Olsen and
the Olsen twins.
The Olsen twins, yeah.
That has a comic connect. Maybe they don't because they wanted to get them to stop their sister from appearing as the Scarlet Witch or something. I don't know. That didn't work really. But so yeah, you want to do your next one?
Yeah, it's funny that you talked about DNA agents, because when I was searching for stuff to read, I came that close to picking Crossfire in a Rainbow. It was a Crossfire Rainbow miniseries, and I almost picked it.
I actually have a limited, very limited telepathy where I can only read your mind, and I can only read like brief glimpses of comics that you're considering to cover for this podcast.
And you kind of sense that Rainbow.
It's not a super useful power, but
I came very close to picking it, but I didn't, and I picked Defiance War Dancer, written by Alan Weiss, with Jim Shooter, created by Alan Weiss. And Defiant was the second company coming out of Valiant by Jim Shooter. The first one, sorry. So he worked at Valiant. Valiant, they kind, it's like the shareholders pushed him out, got him out of Valiant. Mm-hmm. He formed Defiant. Defiant is very similar to his vision of what he was doing at Valiant. So he was creating a new universe. The art styles, the way the books were put together were very much in the vein of Valiant. And then the third one was Broadway. And this one was War Dancer. I haven't read it before. And very much looks and feels like a Valiant comic. This is about a girl who thinks she's going crazy. She's on the cover of People magazine. Her name is Sarah Thornton, and she was like a movie star before she had a nervous breakdown. Well, her breakdown has to be is she keeps on seeing like Mayan images and all kinds of weird stuff, and she's trying to get help, but she's going broke in the process. So you talk about a person that had like infinite amounts of money, and then all of a sudden, because people think she's a whack job, she can't get a job to for anything, and she can't even pay her psychiatrist anymore. So she actually can't see your psychiatrist. It's interesting because she opens the door once and she does a lot of painting, and she paints a lot of these Mayan images, and she doesn't know why she paints them. And she opens the door and she thinks it's a bill collector, and it's this little like 4-year-old kid with his dog, and he says, "I'm lost, you know, can you help us?" And the dog is like a Cocker Spaniel. And she says, "Well, I'll call the police and try to find your parents." And while she's doing that, the kid is running around her house, checking things out. It's driving her crazy. She walks outside when she's like talking to the police, and she runs into this huge Mayan staircase and pyramid. And the thing explodes, and coming out of it is like this Mayan godlike creature, but he looks human, and he's the War Dancer. And this War Dancer comes out, is immediately confronted with a bunch of assholes on bikes, you know, like a motorcycle gang, and he kicks their asses before the police get there. But she takes him in the house, and she says, "I've been seeing this images. I think it's related." And this War Dancer guy, the door rings again, and it's a bunch of creatures. It looks like a bunch of creatures from like Warriors of Plasm, if you were reading that, but I don't think it's those creatures. But War Dancer disposes of them, and there's like 12 of them doing his war dance. And it's kind of funny because it's like it looks like he kicks their asses by breakdancing. But that's kind of funny. Kicks their asses, disposes of them. And then she's like, so she doesn't believe she's crazy anymore. She believes the images she's been seeing are related to this War Dancer. And that little boy and that little kid, a war dancer sees him, and he basically blows up the dog. And the woman's like, "What did you just do?" Because it wasn't a robot. You see, like, intestines and all kinds of shit blow up. And then he does the same thing to the little boy. And he says, "I am the dancer." I don't know what those creatures were that were there, but he killed them both. And that's how the end of the series reads, and the police arrive. So we'll have to see how that ends. But that was Defiant. It came out in, let me see what year it was, 1994.
Yeah, I have never read any Defiant comics. I know of the company and the creators, but I don't really even know. Not only have I read anything, I don't really know what properties they published and
Yeah,
whatnot.
I have a full run of the Defiant and Broadway.
Was only around for a couple of years,
I
right?
actually liked Broadway better. Defiant was a little different with Warriors of Plasm, the good guys, Charlemagne. Those are the ones I remember. Fatal was at Broadway, Starseed, a couple other ones. There were I really liked what he was doing with Broadway. That one was very valiant. Like, this was a little bit different. Defiant was a little different. There was Dark Dominion. That was the other one. He had done like a lot of promos with Defiant. I think the first thing that was launched out of Defiant was like a card comic, like where you'd have to buy the trading cards to form a comic. It was a good issue, and it was good enough that I want to like read the next issue just to see why he killed those kids, the little boy and the dog, because that was kind of shocking. Well, we'll see if I read it for next time or if I jump onto something else.
Yeah, God help anybody that's trying to actually follow along with a series via this podcast. They just hear a lot of stories beginning and none ending.
That's right.
But I mean, I tend to pick a lot of number ones and stuff like that because I feel like it introduces new. Every once in a while, I get in the mood to follow along with something for the show, but I like to introduce different concepts and comics to the show, you know. But anyways, so yeah, so moving on to my next. Speaking of number ones, moving on to my next one. My other two were both drawn by the same person. I didn't do that intentionally. It just kind of worked out that way. But Ron Lim, who I was a fan of as a kid. I mean, I still do like his stuff, but he's somebody that I was aware of when I was a kid because of Captain America and Silver Surfer. And I think part of what drew me to those books actually. Silver Surfer especially was the only thing I really read that was cosmic in nature. Part of what drew me to those books were his penciling. And I think both of these books I'm going to talk about precede, I'm almost positive, precede his work at Marvel. The first one is Hero Alliance. And
I read that whole series too.
this is an innovation comic.
I love that series. You know who told me to read that was Derek Coward.
Oh yeah.
Yeah, he was a huge fan of Hero Alliance.
Nice. Yeah, I didn't know much about it, and that's part of the reason why I ended up buying this number one is actually considered volume two.
Yeah, it is very soap opera and addicting. Like, that's
Yeah.
another one, like DNA agents, that I had to keep reading, and I read the whole series. I don't know if I read the second volume, though. I might
Well,
have.
you probably did because it looks like what's considered volume one is just a handful of issues. There was a initial issue, then there was a Heroes Alliance End of the Golden Age miniseries.
I read this one, but I don't know where the volume.
So yeah, that I think what I just was saying was just that was what was considered volume one, because then there's this.
Oh, Wonder Color, 1987.
So yeah, so
Even a different publisher.
this innovation, it was
I did read it, by the way, the whole thing.
yeah, because there was
17
only
issues and a couple annuals.
yeah, so the volume, what they was calling volume one, was only like 3 or 4 issues, and then this innovation was the longer running 17 so issues. So there's a so I didn't realize that I wasn't picking up the first, in first story about
You
Harry Elias, but
are picking up the first story because the other one is very loosely coupled. I
okay.
remember reading the first one and being disappointed. Like, it's only one issue, and then the innovation one started.
Okay. Nevertheless, I mean, you can pick up on stuff that happened prior to the story starting
Yeah.
through the story and flashbacks and things like that, 'cause we start out with a guy, looks kind of like a superhero, a Superman kind of figure. And he's flying, and sees a little girl that fell off her bike. So even though it's just a simple act, he helps the girl out and takes her to her mom, who offers up some cookies. And something causes him to kind of flash back to the team that he was on, the guardmen, who, because I think actually some of the toys that they have are guardman toys that are, and they're broken in their sandbox, and it kind of makes them think of the real people being broken, or in other words, killed. And so that kind of sours his mood and upsets him. And so there's this background of tragedy of this team failing, and one of his former teammates, we see actually his son in prison. So there's a little bit of, I'll have to say, because whatever happened prior to this issue, I felt like I was doing a little bit of catch up as I followed along, just trying to make note of who the characters were, and it's alluding to stuff that I don't know. It's like, is that something that happened that like I just haven't read, or is it just not filling in the details yet? And as I progress through the issue, I sort of catch up with different things.
I think it's a little bit of both.
Yeah, probably. So this guy that's in prison, Mark, he's the son of a superhero called Golden something. They don't really tell you at this point. We see him in some flashbacks and stuff as a part of a team, because there's a woman at a gravesite, and she's remembering her time on this team with this superhero that's been killed. And then we see his son in prison, and there's a big guy that knocks him over. It seems that he's known in prison as being the son of the superhero, and there's a guy knocks him over, and he seems like he's going to take him as his new prison companion, if you will. And he says things like, "Too bad your old man didn't teach you how to fight. Why don't you put a leotard on? You're going to be my hero now." So we see the guy from the beginning, Victor. He goes back to this real expensive mansion and stuff, and he's got a note from the woman that whose daughter he rescued in the beginning with a phone number. It says, call me, I'm divorced, Cindy's mom. And he's thinking to himself, I almost forgot, according to People magazine, I'm the world's most eligible bachelor. So yeah, throughout the issue, he's like, you get the sense that, yeah, like women are all about this guy. So there's a woman named Chris, who's sunbathing in a bikini by a pool. And she's a teacher. Doesn't seem like they know each other super well. Apparently she's maybe somehow related to the guardman, who's the golden guardman. That's what his name was. She's a lot younger than him, because she says something along the lines of, I hope you don't mind, I gave this number to people who are trying to get a hold of me. I've already missed 3 days of high school classes. And for a second, he's like, uh-oh, high school. She said, don't worry, I'm a teacher. So she's young enough that he could reasonably think that she's a high school student. So a woman shows up at the prison to visit this guy, Mark. He's got a visitor, and it's a blonde woman. She says, you know, I'm an old friend of your father, came to find out how you're doing and make sure you're okay and everything like that. And I think it's the woman that was at the gravesite earlier. Yeah, it is. So she's the woman. So she knows his father. She was just at his gravesite and was worrying about her friend's son in prison and stuff like that. And Mark's not too happy to see her. He tells her she could, if she's a friend of his father, he can drop dead. She's offended by this, but he tells her that he hated his father and that his father cheated on his mom. And she says to the lady, maybe you're one of the tramps he used to sleep with. She gets pissed and she zaps him with a little bit of her powers. Seems to have some kind of like energy powers or something. Gives him a little zap in the face and tells him, I could teach you a lesson or two. I'm one of the original guardsmen. And he's not too impressed with her. We get the sense that there's, in the background, there's been a lot of tragedy and things have gone too well. It's kind of got a little bit of a Watchmen vibe to it, but there's a Batman kind of character who he has more of a wants to take a dark vigilante approach later in the issue. Victor, he's trying to put together a new version of the Guardman, but Sentry, who's the Batman kind of character, he brings along a few these drug pushers that he's picked up. He kind of brings them to the meeting and throws them on the ground. And so should we go ahead and kill him? And Victor is kind of the Superman sort. He says, you know, that's not the way we're going to handle things. Sentry says, man, if I keep hanging around with you, I'm not going to be able to frighten anybody. I'm not even going to be able to frighten a Cub Scout. But there's a few other heroes there. And there's two guys that show up. They're called Gemini Plus. They're twin brothers and they're like young guys that really excited about like being superheroes in terms of in a kind of rock star kind of way, where they want to get the chicks and stuff. Like all these three women show up that they don't have any powers or anything like that. They just dressed up in superhero costumes, like really super skimpy ones. And like Gemini says, plus like this brother, the two brothers, the one says to the other, man, see what I told you? Chicks, man, we could take our pick. And but they're actually all just interested in Victor and come up on him and everything like that. And finally, Chris, the woman that was at Victor's house, she shows up, and one of the women that are hanging out, Victor says, "Is that one of your groupies?" So she gets, she's like, "All right." And the girls reveal that they're from a sorority, and they're like, "We thought we could hang out and party." And despite the fact that Gemini is pretty excited about these girls being around, Chris takes her, picks up a brick. She's like, "All right. You must be used to initiations if you're from a sorority. First, you got to have soft, silky hair. You need a pretty face and a gorgeous body. And you have to crush a brick with your bare hands. Crunch." So the three of them get freaked out and jump into a car and take off. And Gemini comes up against her and says, "Hey, you're my favorite the whole time. Did you mention, did I happen to mention that I caught the villain Sepulchre all by myself?" So yeah, he brought this guy, Sepulchre, that looks like a zombie, sort of green skin, all wrinkly, like wiry black hair. And to Gemini's chagrin, Victor tells him, "You know, Sepulchre has always just kind of been joke of the week to us. He's never really been more than a nuisance. It's nice you went out of your way to help, but and that's what really counts. But to Victor's surprise, Sepulchre, of course, takes exception to being called a joke and a nuisance. But Sepulchre surprises them all by taking credit for the original guardsmen being killed. So Victor flips out all the other heroes, trying to hold them back from attacking Gemini. And Gemini, meanwhile, is taunting Victor and say, "Hey, this is my work's done. I did what I wanted to do. I got my name known. Go ahead and kill me. That'll even just cement me in history, basically." And so Victor gets away from the other heroes and grabs him, flies into space, well, up into the clouds, rather. And seem, you know, he's tempted to kill him, but finally, Victor lets him go, doesn't kill him. And then, like, later at night, we see him struggling and frustrated with the fact that he's thinking of all the times they let him go. 16 times they let him go. We let him go. And he attacks a building that's under construction. I think it was actually a complex that they were building for the new team. He just demolishes it to let go of his anger. And that's kind of how the issue ends. There's only one brief scene right before that where a woman named Tawny Winters, who seems like she's going to be part of the ongoing story as it goes on. She's a real beautiful woman that has a lot of tabloid attention. And throughout the issue, there's this repeating theme of sometimes you feel the weight of the world and you wonder if your life is a mistake. It keeps kind of repeating that in relation to the other, into various characters in the book. So, yeah, as I said, Ronald Lim was the illustrator. Kevin Juari and David Campitti are the authors. Keith Williams is the inker. Marcus David, colorist, and Bill Oakley, letterer. It was called Easy Targets. Yeah, as you said, it was pretty superhero-y.
It's a lot. It focuses a lot on
soap opera-y.
It focuses a lot on relationships and stuff. Like DC Comics had a comic way after this one called Young Heroes in Love, and it's very similar to that. It's weird, but they also have their their Superman, their Batman. You know, it's kind of like. They're, what are they called? What's the word?
Analogs.
Yeah, analogs. They have all those characters. Plus, there's weird ones like Gemini, where the two brothers and some. There's some unique characters, but there's a lot of analogs in there.
Yeah, it's kind of interesting the time, like when it came out, early '80s and stuff. I mean, you can kind of see it as a. Another example of what at that time it really was a new thing to be doing in superheroes and taking a different look at them. And doing analogs of the DC Trinity, which you had like with Squadron Supreme at Marvel and things like that. And, like, sort of an earlier example of that, one that's not as well known as a lot of the other other series in the similar time period.
It's really good, though. I liked it. I read that. That was another one where I just kind of like bought the whole series, like a full run on eBay, and just read it. And I liked it a lot because I remember going by and buying the Golden Age one, which is a prequel to this. And then the one that's even before that one. And then there's a tie in with the Justice Machine. And so there's a few books that you can track down if you like this.
Yeah, I thought it was pretty good. I mean, I feel like I would have to read a little bit more to see where they go with the plot lines and see how they develop them to see if it was a decent first issue, it was off to a decent start.
Yeah.
I think it's an example of, like, as far as the art, an early example of Ron Lim. I mean, he's got his storytelling pretty strong already off the bat. There's no real confusion as to what's happening, and things are choreographed well. I would say that you can see that his maybe it's a difference in inking and things like that too, but it doesn't seem quite as refined. It doesn't have just the same quality of line that some of his later work does. But I think it was kind of an early project for him, so he's still developing.
Yep. My final choice was Cinnamon El Cinclo from DC Comics. It's a 5-issue miniseries. If you're into the Western genre of DC, Cinnamon's a female character that, you know, first appeared in Weird Western Tales way back in the day. And she's appeared recently in the All-Star Western as a backup by Palmiotti and Gray. And the reason I read this series is it's by Jen Van Meter. And Jen Van Meter is going to be writing the new Dr. Mirage series for Valiant Comics. So I was like, hey, that's probably a good thing to read. It's a female, strong female character. I'll see what this is about. I thought it was going to be a Western, but it's not. It's like taking Cinnamon out of the Western genre and putting her into current day. This is from 2003. The art is by Francisco Peronozini. And the inker is Robert Campanella. And the interesting thing about this look and feel of the book is if you've ever read 100 Bullets by Russo,
yep,
it looks like Russo art. Like you would look at this art and say, is that 100 Bullets? It even has the look and feel of 100 Bullets, even the storytelling. So if you're a 100 Bullets fan, I recommend you check this out.
That's cool.
But it takes place in Mexico. And this senator's kid is, you know, flapping his wallet around and buying drugs, and these two guys were going to go rob him, and she stops the robbery but doesn't give the guy his wallet back. She keeps his wallet, stops the robbery, kind of saves his life. And he's like, she knows this guy's like an asshole, like a rich guy. He's a rich kid that just comes to Mexico to get what he wants and then leave. So she lets him go, saves his life, though, because he would have been killed. And then her whole job is she's kind of like a mercenary slash bodyguard. She gets these odd jobs where she'll be a bouncer, or she'll be paid to, like, take this shipment from one point to another point. And the first job she takes, it gives a flashback story about her, and it took place in a bank, and you see like 7 bandits robbing a bank and shooting a cop because he's got his badge out and he's dead. Well, she was the daughter of that cop, so that's kind of like her origin story. And now she's kind of like just taking odd jobs here and there. So she helps this guy take supposedly books across this one highway, and these bandits were there to steal them, and she has a gunfight and ends up shooting them all until the cops show up. And she says, "You should be safe going out on your own from here on out." So she knew there was going to be some trouble. She saved this guy. She gets paid. And then she heads to a bar with one of her friends, and the bartender says, "Hey, somebody's been in here asking for you, and this is what she looks like." And she knows that can't be good, so she goes on a bus trip trying to find this person. Well, that person is Cinnamon is a character driven by vengeance, and she remembered every one of those guys that was at the bank. And she essentially killed them all. And one of the guys she killed was the daughter, had a daughter, and that daughter, when she was like 7, saw the murder, and she wants to have vengeance on Cinnamon because she killed her father, and she didn't know the backstory of him robbing a bank or anything. All she knows is that Cinnamon killed her father. So that's what the whole thing centers around. Is that one character, and she's a cool character, the other one, because she is protecting a bunch of homeless kids. Like, she takes kids on the street and she gives them a place to live. She keeps them out of like prostitution rings. Well, she actually happens to get the senator's daughter because the senator's daughter's running away from her father for whatever no for whatever reason. And she starts protecting her. Well, the senator puts a reward out for anybody that can find her daughter, and they get involved in this. So it's pretty much a vengeance story, along with them becoming friends, even though they want to kill each other. Cinnamon finds out she is the daughter of somebody she killed, and she pretty much says, "Okay, I'll meet you in the alleyway. We'll have this gunfight." And she's not going to draw her gun. And her best friend owns like a strip club, and he's like, "You're going to die, aren't you?" And so they have this draw, and she purposely misses the woman because she knows it's her time to go. And she gets shot in the leg, and she lives. And she ends up helping this character because the senator goes to try to retrieve her daughter and blows up the building that they're staying in and kills a lot of people, and the senator's up to no good. And I didn't get to finish the story because it's a 5-issue story and I have 1 through 4, so I read 1 through 4, and I don't know. They basically go see the senator, but I don't know what happens after that. And it's kind of like a Thelma and Louise thing, as they team up to go find out what's going on. And I don't get to see what the conclusion is, but I have to buy it to figure out what's happening. But it's really good. It's highly recommended. It's kind of like a Vertigo story. If you like any Quentin Tarantino movies or stuff like that, I think you'll enjoy it. Like Kill Bill, it's kind of in that vein. It's pretty neat.
That's cool. Yeah, I could see. I mean, Kill Bill definitely. Obviously, there's a lot of martial arts influence on that, but there's definitely a Western aspect to it too.
Oh, the Western vengeance type story to it.
Yeah.
That's what this one has. It doesn't have any martial arts. It has a lot of gunfighting, but that's pretty much where it stops. But that was 1 through 4 that I described, and 1 through 5. 5 should be interesting because they end up getting the. These two guys end up. They're like bounty hunters. They end up finding the daughter of the senator and retrieving her. And then these two go after those two bounty hunters, and they walk into the room, and the two bounty hunters are found dead. So the girl's missing, and the two guys are dead. So you think the senator wants to kill his own daughter for whatever reason. And it gives some backstory, like she might have overheard something. It's kind of like you know what it reminded me of Batman Eternal with the Clue Master and Stephanie Brown. It's kind of like Stephanie Brown, overheard something that she shouldn't have overheard, and her father's out to kill her.
Yeah.
This is very similar to what he's out, the senator's after his own daughter, to kill her. And these two women, Cinnamon, and I can't remember the other girl's name, but they're protecting her. So we'll see how that turns out. But man, it was good story. I really enjoyed it.
Nice.
Howard Chaykin covers too. Forgot to mention that.
Oh, right. Yeah, that was why I didn't. Sometimes, if you just happen to glance at the covers and you don't really take a look as to what who the interior artist is, so I've seen the covers of those and never would have thought that it had sort of a 100 Bullets look to it, because that's not Howard Chaykin's style. So I never really looked to see who the interior artist on that was. So.
I'm gonna take a few pictures and post them on Facebook, and you can tell me what you
Yeah,
think.
that'd be cool. It's interesting how even with it not being the same artist, you associate a certain style. Like, I haven't picked it up yet, or I mean, I haven't read it yet, but I got the fifth Animal Man volume, the Vertigo series. They put out a, I think actually they put out a sixth trade now too, but I got the fifth one that I haven't read yet, and that was a stretch where Rick Veitch was writing it, and Dylan was the artist, Steve Dylan.
Yeah.
And because Preacher was one of the first series I ever really read with Steve Dylan art, I always immediately think of Preacher when I see Steve Dylan art. But it's just an association I have in my head. But I didn't read Preacher. Maybe someday I'll reread that again. But my final indie, 80s indie number one, also featuring art of Ron Lim, is X Mutants number one.
That is so weird. No, it's just bizarre because I did not read a lot of indies, but all the titles you've chose, I've read the entire series.
But are they all, are they, so are these also like DNA agents where you read them later on though, not at the time, or?
The one you just talked about,
Hero Alliance.
Hero Alliance, I read because of a podcast.
So
Derek
that, yeah, so it was later
Coward
on.
loved it. DNA Agents, I ran across a trade, which was a black and white trade that covered the first six issues, and I really liked it.
Yeah.
So I went back and bought the whole series. And there's other volumes of DNA Agents too. This one that you're talking about, I had discovered The Protectors, which is a this
Okay.
is a Malibu publication, right?
Actually, it's Eternity Comics.
Okay, I didn't read it, the Eternity X Mutants. I read the when it went to Malibu.
Oh, okay.
So what you're talking about now, I didn't read. It just happens to be that the X Mutants property went over to Malibu, and that's how I discovered The Protectors. I loved it so much that I had to go buy Dinosaurs for Hire and X Mutants.
Okay.
And then, not far after those books came out, then they launched the Ultraverse. But
Right.
it caught me into their label, if you will. In other words, I enjoyed them so much that. So yeah, maybe I have to go seek those Eternity ones out.
Yeah, I don't know if they just continued on with the story
I
when they
think
went.
it's we'll say the writer, and I'll check to see if it's the same guy.
Yeah, so this was written by David Lawrence and Anthony Pereira, Pereira. This is the episode of us mispronouncing last
Everything.
names. Artists Ronald Lim and Mike Witherbee. I guess Witherbee is the inker. Bob Pinaha as the letterer, and no colorist because this is black and white. And I'm surprised actually now that I'm looking. I thought
Rob
that this.
Carringer?
Nope.
What issue is this?
Number one.
Oh, this one has it listed as Robert Carringer and Anthony Pereira with Robin Lim. Huh.
Yeah, it's red background on the cover.
Yeah, it looks like a reprint from no, I'm this has a weird series. This is a weird series, but it's funny that your credits didn't have Robert Carringer there. Maybe my database is wrong.
Yeah, this has a red cover with a background with a black square
Yeah,
that
it has a guy with the sword, two girls behind him with swords. Well, actually, four girls
that yeah, four
behind him with
girls and then
swords.
everybody has swords.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not too sure what the whole history of this book was. I'm popping on to to Wikipedia here, so let's see. First published by Eternity Comics and then Amazing Comics. Contractual problems resulted in a move to Pied Piper Comics. A legal dispute followed, and after running out of money for the struggle, the creators surrendered. The title returned to Eternity Comics and then was later published in a revamped version by Malibu Comics.
That's the one that I know, but the Malibu was Chris Ulm, Dave Ulbrich, Tom Mason, and the artist was Paul Pelletier.
Okay.
That's the series I read. So I read 1992, whereas you were in 1986. So it's quite a time period jump there.
Yeah, this is pretty crazy publication history. So what I'm holding here is issue one published by Eternity in 1986, and then Amazing Comics published a special edition number one. Maybe that was a reprint or something.
It looks like the same cover.
Yeah, Amazing Comics then published issues 2 through 5 in 86. Then Pied Piper Comics published 6 through 8 in 1987. But then it went back to Eternity and they continued the Amazing Comics numbering. So there was a number 6 and 7 again. And then they published the X-Mutants Shattered Earth Chronicles issues 1 through 15 in 88 through 90.
And if you're really
And then
interested,
an
in
annual.
1988, you could get the pop-up book, and it's got a girl in a bikini.
Oh, okay.
X-Mutants pin-up. No, it's not a pop-up. Maybe
Pop
the pin-up book will make you pop up.
up.
I
Exactly. Yeah, that was a Freudian slip on your part right
Yeah.
there. Yeah, then they did an annual and a winter special, and then finally X-Mutants issues 1 through 18 at Malibu in 92 through 94. Wow. What a publishing history.
And that's the one that I liked. I mean, well, I don't know. I never read the other ones, but I have a
Yeah.
full run of the other series.
That's crazy. Well, yeah, so I thought that this was later than Hero Alliance, because I actually think Ron Lim's art in this looks more refined. So maybe it really is just it's a difference of inker, because this actually precedes Hero Alliance by a few years. But either way, this might have been my favorite of the three.
Really?
Yeah, I did like it. But I just found it interesting.
The cover doesn't pop out at me as being very good.
It does not. And I did not expect to like it. I've had it for a while.
Is it col is it color? Black and white?
It's black and white.
Maybe that's why the art's popping out at you.
And that could be it too, yeah. So it starts out with a woman looking in a mirror. And in the mirror, she sees herself as a really beautiful woman. But in reality, she is just a hideous mutant covered with boils and varicose veins, and she's wearing a tattered garment. Her hair barely looks like hair. It just looks like these thick strings coming from patchy scalp. And her name's Lorelei, and she's interrupted by a man who's a little bit more human looking, But he's got a third eye in his forehead and no nose. And behind him are a bunch of other just mutated looking beings. And then we get a little bit of a flashback to summer day in August of 1945 when one war ended and another war suddenly began. So, in this background of this world, not surprisingly, you know, we're being published in the 80s. There was a lot of Cold War fear that the end of the world would come with all this nuclear armaments. And in the world of X-Mutants, those fears were realized. So we had the atomic bomb dropped in World War II. And then some time went on and nothing happened. But then sometime in the 80s, it did happen. One day it did happen. Someone, somewhere, and let's face it, it really doesn't matter who, ordered the weapons used. And it's just kind of like a generic-looking, like, dictator guy. But then we see Reagan and Gorbachev pressing their buttons. And then we see just a picture of the Earth from outer space. And there's just little little indications on the maps, like almost like ripples in a sea of atomic bombs going off. So fast forward to an Earth that's pretty much decimated. It's barely, the planet itself has barely survived. Mankind has not survived. But here in the ruins of what once was New York City, something else did. So the only life that's left on Earth is are these mutated beings, to varying degrees. Some look a little more human than others, but none of them just look like straight up humans. And we see the guy from the beginning that had the third eye. He's digging in a rubble and finds something that he's been looking for at long last. And then thwack, he gets smacked on the back of the head with a shovel by this mutant named Mitchell. And because they think, hey, the doc's found something. What's he got? And he grabs it from him, and Mitchell's like, what the hell is this? And the doc says it's a compact solar battery. So they give it back to him because they're like, what the hell's your problem? It's not something we can eat or sleep with. If it's not food or something I can fuck, I don't want it. So the doc goes back down.
If it's not food I can fuck?
Not food or something I can fuck. I don't know, though. It's,
you
know,
I want to fuck my food.
It's in this world, you never know. In this dystopian future, it's quite possible.
I only eat my food after I fuck it.
Ooh. You might want to do that in a different order. Oh, man. Oh, you just brought back a weird memory.
Oh, no. It's a memory.
A memory of something I saw and not did, fortunately. But I just remember when I was like 18 or something, we went over, like my friend and I went over to our friend's house, and he was like really poorly supervised. Like he lived with his brother, and his parents just like took off. They were like absentee parents. Like they were never around. So obviously when we were like teenagers, that was like a hilarious place to, or like an awesome place to hang out.
Yeah.
And I just remember one time we were there, and he put on this like real nasty porno tape that he found. And it had this dude in a kitchen giving it to a turkey.
Oh, jeez. Like,
he was in a kitchen at a restaurant, and he like put this turkey on the table and went at it. And,
was it Poltergeist?
No. But he was doing it, and then they like served the turkey to these people. It was nasty. Oh, man. So, yeah, some things like that you just can never unsee. Anyways, getting back to X-Mutants. So the doctor, he takes this device he needed to finish his experiment. And what he does is they're called X-Mutants because he takes five mutants and is able to, for the second time, in my comics today, we have people in big giant test tubes. And what emerged from these are, including Lorelei, from the beginning, five human-looking people. Not only are they human-looking people, they're five attractive people. One guy and four women. The guy's name is Belushi. So I don't know if he was a denizen of the of an animal house or a Blues Brother in the in his past life. But and then we have Aaron, Vicky, Angela, and like I said, Lorelai. And so for weeks, he begins training them. He knows that he wants them to go out into the world, but he knows that they need to be able to defend themselves. And the reason they have swords on the cover is because they train a lot of martial arts. And there's another reason to that, and I'll get to that later and sort of like the background of the idea of this story. But so they spend a lot of time together. Over time, the doctor ends up kind of thinking of them more as like his kids. And then eventually, today is the day he's going to let them out onto the surface. And he knows it's going to be dangerous. That's why he's trained them in martial arts and in weapons. He sets off a flare and intentionally attracts attention of all like the mutants in the area, some like Mitchell and some of the other guys that he knows by name. And naively, the doctor thinks that these mutants are going to be excited that he's finally found a way to return the human race to the Earth. It's the rebirth of the human race, he announces. And maybe we're not too surprised, but the doctor's surprised when the mutants, they just start throwing rocks. Humans, get them! And so they have to put their combat skills into immediate use. They have to fight off all these mutants as they attack and try to kill these brand new humans. And they're starting to get overrun. Most of the mutants, they want to kill them. There's like maybe one or two guys that there's one mutant at least who thinking to himself, he doesn't say anything to his other mutants, but thinking that they looked like gods. So we see like a different perspective that maybe could have been taken for them. But the doctor, he gives them a car to take off in, and he escapes down into his bunker, which is impenetrable. But they want to stay with him, but he says, no, the whole purpose I created you for was to bring the human race back to the Earth. You have to reclaim the world. That's your job, to take the world back from the mutants. And we get a little foreshadowing of a threat to them, that there's this guy who's this real, real huge guy who wears a hockey mask. And I don't know if his name is Jason, but it might be. But one of his little underlings reports to him what's happened. And he knows about it, and he's got a plan. But we don't find out what that plan is. We catch up with the ex-mutants. They're camping out for the night. And there's a little bit of a funny thing where the guy, Belushi, you know, he points out that what we might have picked up on, that, you know, look, you ladies haven't figured out why there's four of you and only one of me. We're breeding stock. We're out to repopulate the Earth. So Belushi, you know, and the doctor may have actually intended this, considering what he says. Four women and one guy, but to most ladies' credit, they're not just going to sign up on board to be four women that he can impregnate. However, after they go to sleep separately, one of the women, Vicky, she's real into like her physical appearance and stuff. We get a little bit of foreshadowing of her activity here. She shows up into his tent and says, if we have to repopulate the entire world, don't you think we better get started? And we see a shadow of them embracing. And
all of them?
No, just Vicky.
Okay.
So, yeah, just the the one. So she's into his suggestion. Later on, she sneaks over to his tent, and just as he's thinking, "Hey, man, they don't have any sense of humor or whatever," and so the women have different sort of different opinions of him. They're starting to lay the ground for that, at least. Like Lorelai, the one from the beginning, she's totally offended. Vicky, obviously, we see is totally on board with the idea and goes and sleeps with them. And then, Aaron, she's kind of like in the middle. She thinks he's kind of cute, but she doesn't show up at his tent in the middle of the night. So they did notice she was missing in the morning. Lorelai says to Vicky, "What happened to you yesterday? You were missing half the night." She says, "Oh, I just decided to scout around." And Lorelai says, "Well, don't do it again. Who knows what you might get into?" And we see that she and Belushi are blushing, but they have their faces turned away from the rest of the girls. So they pop back into their car and are just, there's no traffic or anything like that. So they're just flying down this highway and not really paying attention. And unfortunately, because Belushi's driving, but he's not looking. And before they have time to stop, they reach a point in the road where the road is actually obstructed by a huge pile of rubble, as you'd kind of expect. It's not like anyone's been keeping the roads clear. So, bam, crack, crang, they're in a convertible, so they all get thrown from the cars. It's flying through the air, and thankfully they land nearby, and the car doesn't land on top of them, but they are all knocked out, at least, if not worst. And as the issue ends, we see some mutants or some kind of shadowy creatures in the background approaching their passed out bodies. To be continued.
Do you, on all of these series, do you have follow-up issues, or is that it?
All of them, I have two or three more issues. When I bought them, I bought a few issues of each to give myself enough to sample. But I did mention, like a lot of these issues this time period, that there is a text piece in the back. And one thing I did think was interesting from this was that this actually did start out as a joke due to the popularity of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. A bunch of the creators were around, and they made a joke that they would do kind of the reverse, like a world that's all mutants and there's only five real people. And the joke name at first was Young Ex-Mutant Samurai Humans instead of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. So they dropped everything but the ex-mutants. But that's where the martial art thing comes. They did keep a little bit of the martial arts and them being trained and all being samurai and having swords. They did keep that from the original concept. So it started out as a joke, and then they said, "Hey, you know what? Maybe we can actually make something of that." So, and there's a
Had quite a bit of I guess some success, 'cause it ran it through a couple publishers.
yeah, I mean, there's like enough interest in the topic or the idea, that a number of different people in charge of different companies are obviously willing to take a chance on it. But I think I just liked the concept of turning that whole idea on its head. You do have situations where there's only a few survivors, obviously, like Walking Dead. I mean, there's just tons and tons of examples. Of post-apocalypse situations where there's only a small amount of humans left, but I find it. I think I was drawn in by the fact that there's only five of them, and not only are there's only five, but they're not like humans that have survived thus far. Like humanity didn't survive at all, and there's just this guy that's a mutant, but he's got enough of his brain left that he's one of the few that's actually interested in trying to do more than just survive. And I like that the five humans actually are like what the title says, ex-mutants. It's that they're not humans that survive, but they're actual mutants that got converted back into human beings, and they have like their issues with because they remember being mutants and stuff. So enough of a twist on the genre that it grabbed me. And I think, like I said, the Ron Lim, the artwork here is the way that it's inked, has like some of the sharpness that I associate with his Marvel work that I liked. So that was a plus for me too.
Nice.
Gia. And that is my
You
last
should scan in a
comic.
page so I could see what the interior looks like.
Yeah, I can do that actually, yeah.
I'll send you those Russo on my, I'll post them on my wall and tag you, and you could just reply and say, well,
Yeah.
here's the here's what Ron Lim's art looks like in black and
Yeah, maybe we can like once the episode's up with show notes and stuff,
white.
you could put the images in there too or something, so people that
Yeah.
listen to the episode if they want to check them out too.
Yeah, if you send it, I'll do that.
Cool. Yeah, I can do that. Yeah, I was actually just fiddling around with the printer earlier because I Kara had a wireless printer that stopped interfacing with her laptop for some reason, and a couple weekends ago I pulled it out and started playing around with it and got it to at least interface with my laptop, and it's got a scanner on it, and I was scanning some stuff this morning
Scan
because
it in, scan it in.
scanning it I was scanning it I was doing the doing a Knutson.
Knutson, except Knutson never gets it scanned.
That can mean a lot of things really, doing a
Could,
Knutson.
you have to be plastered.
Yeah.
That's the real test. Can you scan it in drunk?
Keep it straight.
Yeah.
Scan in diagonals. Normally it's like, oh, come on, Pumbaa. There we go. You hear that?
Yeah.
That's, there we go. Pumbaa's doing a different kind of Knutson.
There you go.
Anyways, so yeah, the reason I was scanning stuff in, I guess I could, unless you have anything else, I can segue us into our close up.
Yeah, you can segue us in.
The reason I was scanning some stuff was because, again, my next post for over at Taylor Network, Chris's Cosmic Treadmill. I've got a three installments, I think, so far. Like most of the time, it comes up on Tuesday, and I'm just reviewing any kind of comic I feel like. And I got another last week. I did a Legion of Superheroes issue 260, the original volume. And I was scanning in some images for my one this week. It's going to be Green Lantern, Volume 1, Issue 126. And like that Legion episode or that Legion issue, these are actually follow-ups on issues that I covered for the Mythmaking, etc. podcast, which you can still download from iTunes. And so that's something I've been doing. But you can find that. Also, those articles are, I link them to them on my blog at mythmakingetc.com. And mythmakingetc is your key to finding me on social media, because I'm mythmakingetc@gmail.com and mythmakingetc on Twitter. Whereas Mike is mike@comicbooknoise.com and Mike Myers Brunch on Twitter.
Or myth making brunch.
Or mythmakingbrunch is what you do if you want to eat imaginary food
Yeah.
in the morning. I am mythmakingbrunch in your imagination.
Leave an iTunes review. We'd appreciate it.
Yes.
And one sh another shout out is that Brian Raygate, who gave us our question, he also has a podcast and it's called Comics and History. It's available at speaker.com website, so go check it out. He said he gave us a shout out on an episode.
Oh, sweet. I'll have to check that out. That sounds like something I would really dig, actually. I'm a big fan of comic book history, especially like I love listening to podcasts about comic book history and
I
stuff.
think I'm gonna forward you this email.
Cool. Yeah, like that'd be cool. Geekbrunchpodcast.com is where you can find the episodes, and we're on Stitcher, right? Because all the
we're not on
comic book
Stitcher
noise.
yet.
Oh, okay, is some comic book noise stuff on Stitcher?
Yeah,
DC
DC
noise
noises.
and yeah, some stuff. But yeah, well,
I need to get on Stitcher, so I'll get off my ass sometime.
That's cool.
I am so behind. This week has been.
I don't know how many
what,
people. Barb, use
Barb hurting her ankle and stuff. It's like I have to do stuff that I don't normally do.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah, so
I know it's like I mean, care if one of us gets sick, you know? It's like
yeah, it's like I have to do laundry,
extra
and
work,
this and that, and I'm not used to doing all that. I'm used to lounging on the couch. Like yesterday, I had to mow the grass because today I have to do stuff.
Oh yeah, I saw a picture of you with your bandana on and stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. What was I gonna say? Yes, well, Stitch. Oh yeah, so we're part of the comic book podcast, Comic Book Noise Podcast Network, or Deliberate Noise Podcast Network. Deliberate Noise includes Comic Book Noise and other non-comic book podcasts. You can check out a bunch of tons of different shows. One I've been listening to and actually is in the Comic Book Noise feed. I don't know if it has its own feed, but it might be of interest to listeners of this show, is Marvel Bronze Age. It's done by one of the hosts of Mighty Thorcast.
Ed Moore?
Yeah, Ed Moore. Thank you. But that's been pretty cool. It's like they've kind of returned for a second volume of that show after hiatus, and they're going through and covering a lot of different Marvel Bronze Age books, and they really go into detail about each issue and stuff. So you might like that if you like the show and you like old comics, or even if you hate the show but you like old comics and for some reason are listening to the end of this episode. So...
All right. Well, you have a good one, and congrats, Uncle Chris.
Thank you. Yeah, Emily probably won't be ready to appear on the next episode, but
we could try. We could try to dial her in.
Yeah, get her a little iPhone or something. She can
see
download
if she remembers what you told her about Wonder Woman and Batman.
Yeah, here's your first quiz. Okay, now when you were 22 hours old.
When you're 22 hours old, what island did Wonder Woman come from?
Yeah. I told you Bruce Wayne. Oh, shit, I just gave you the answer. Damn it. Let's go with Mike's question.
All right.
All right, man.
I'll talk to you later, and you have a good one. Congrats again.
Thanks.
All right.
And hope you have a quieter week.
Yeah, it should be good. I'll be busy at work, but should be okay.
Yeah.
All right, talk to you later. Bye.
Bye-bye.
I think this couple of wankers, see?
Yeah.